Welcome back to Access Bodybuilding with me, Aaron Singerman, and my co-host, Christina Voynich. Christina, this is normally when I would say what's in the news this week, but you actually are in New Zealand, and due to the whole travel and rigmarole and everything, we're just going to do a little update for everybody, and then we'll introduce our guest. What's up?
I'm great. You're a little tired. You know, the flight is long from Chicago to New Zealand. So it's a good flight. You know, you learn to sleep a lot. But I was telling you off here earlier, I think I spent 22 hours in airplanes over the last 2 days. So wow. Needless to say, I'm still in bed at 11 or 12 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, it's 12 o'clock in the afternoon there, and it's 6:30 there here. So pretty crazy. So yeah. And are you a day ahead?
Yes, I am. So I'm a full day and a half ahead. I think it's like 15 hours different.
So you did 22 hours. I'm sure they broke that up. So where did you fly from Chicago to where, and then where to where?
Yeah, I went from Chicago to LA, which is about 4 hours. And then from LA to, I had a layover in Sydney, Australia. So from LA to Sydney is 15 hours. And then I had a 3 hour flight from Sydney to Auckland, New Zealand, where I am now. So it was a long day, long couple days.
And you're fortunate enough to get to fly in business class. So you said you could actually recline the seat, huh?
Yeah, you know, last year I went to Sydney for the Health and Fitness Expo, and I flew economy, and oh my God, it was hell, because, you know, I was in like a middle seat, and when you're in that small, because you think the planes would be a little bit bigger, you feel like you'd have a little more room in economy, but you don't. It's the same as if you're flying like Southwest. You don't have much more room. But in business class, it's great. You can fully recline. So when I went to India last year, or earlier this year rather, we flew business, and yeah, you can fully recline. They give you, you know, the blanket and the pillow, so you can actually sleep. So I slept for about maybe 6 hours on the flight. Then you have all your movies you can pick from. So I was kind of off and on sleeping for the whole 15 hours.
So you're on this trip for Optimum Nutrition. Exactly what are you doing there, and who are you doing it with?
Yeah, actually, it's pretty cool. I get to travel again with Charles Glass. I went to India with him, with one of our other athletes. And then on this trip, him and I are doing New Zealand for a week. And then we're in Melbourne and then Sydney next week. It's pretty cool. You know, we get to do seminars, and we're doing like product launch for our Amino Energy, which is one of our new products. So it's cool. We'll do seminars. We'll head out to a lot of the local gyms, just kind of meet and greet people. So it's nice. You kind of building brand relationships, and you kind of just get to hang out with people that, you know, are excited to meet you and excited to talk about product that you probably would never get the chance, you know, to meet in the States. So it's cool. You know, we don't have too much going on here in New Zealand. We just have a seminar later this evening, and then a couple gym appearances, and then we fly out Saturday to go to Melbourne. So kind of a...
Will you get to see Mo Al-Masawi while you're there?
No, I don't think I will. Because
I was hoping you could give us a progress update. Remember I said how he told us how he was going to be like back in shape for the, I think he said the Phoenix Pro Show. I think it would be his first show. So it's a shame. I wanted to see if he is already growing.
Yeah, you know, I was talking with our distributors out here because they picked me up from the airport, and we were, you know, just talking about the industry, and they had mentioned Mo, because I guess the guy had used to, our distributor out here used to compete bodybuilding, and the female, she used to do a figure. So we were just talking about the industry in general, and I had mentioned, you know, is there any chance maybe Mo will be around in anything we're doing? And they're like, no, I don't think he's gonna come out and make it, because I was thinking that. Because didn't he say that he's going to put on, you know, all this size to get ready to compete? So I was like, oh, I wanted to get a glimpse myself, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, if you get any opportunities like that, make sure you use your iPhone recorder and get us a quote if you see anything interesting.
I'm ready.
Good, I know you are.
I'm willing and ready.
now, you told me something interesting about Charles Glass in India. You said that his popularity in India was surprising. That's surprising to me. What kind of popularity did you witness?
Yeah, you know, this was a little surprising to me. You know, in the States, a lot of people in the industry, I mean, everybody knows who Charles Glass is, but you, at the Arnold, people would just walk by Charles and not even realize who he is. You know, he just kind of fits in with, you know, with everyone else sometimes. So they're not really sure, you know, the big name that Charles Glass is. But in India, oh my God, like it was. At one point, we got stopped at the airport, and people were taking pictures with him. And the response over in India was incredible. He's a pretty big name, more so I think than we all thought. Same thing in New Zealand and Australia, he's pretty popular too. But in India, he is literally the godfather of bodybuilding to them.
I wonder how and why. You have any idea why and how?
Well, I think in India, how they view nutrition and training, if they read it from an expert, it's almost considered gospel. And I'm not saying this for everyone, but that's, you know, generally the population over there, that's how they look at it. So I think they've grown up reading Charles Glass, reading his articles and watching his training videos, that they take that so seriously because they're so enthusiastic about bodybuilding and training over there. It's completely different than in the States. So I think they've really held tight to his teaching. And so to them, it's like, you know, gospel training. And they think that he's, you know, the number one guy for that.
Wow. Interesting.
Which he is, but they, you know, when they read something, it's, like I said, it's like gospel.
Now, yeah. I don't know Charles well, but I do know he's kind of like unassuming, and he's not like a very big personality wise, you know, when he walks, he's not like, he doesn't make an entrance or anything by any means. So
it's not like Andy Heyman's walking.
He's unassuming. He's very unassuming. So how does he react when he gets this kind of fanfare?
You know, Charles loves this type of stuff. You know, this is his life. This is his passion. So you get him talking about training and, you know, he'll just keep going. And it's cool because we have open forums where, you know, we'll have a crowd of like 400 or 500 people in an auditorium, and they kind of pass the microphone around and they can ask us all questions. And it's funny because I kind of get brushed to the side sometimes because all the men are so excited to ask Charles questions. But he loves it. I mean, Charles is a little quiet to some people, but once you get out and you start traveling with him and you really get to know him, he's a really cool guy, and he loves doing all of this for people.
Cool. Well, Christina, I told you earlier, take pictures, and if you have a chance, post them on our thread. It'll be up tonight or tomorrow, whenever you get a chance, so people can see where you are and what you're doing. I know people will be interested to see New Zealand from Christina's perspective.
Yes, I will do everything I can. It's, you know, I'll be posting them probably, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, central time, and it'll be 4 in the afternoon here or something crazy. So yeah, I'll definitely try to post pictures for everybody as soon as I get the chance we're here. And then whenever I get to Australia, I'll do the same thing.
All right. Well, great. Basically, what we're going to do next, Christina, is I've got an interview with Larry Pepe, the resident expert, bodybuilding expert at Pro Bodybuilding Weekly. And he used to do a show with Dave Palumbo. He started with Noble Radio with him. And now he has his own show, Pro MMA Radio. So we're going to bring him on. And I will bid you adieu and have a lot of fun and a productive trip. And keep me updated and upload some pictures.
All right, you got it.
Thank you, Christina.
Yep.
RxMuscle.com. Now you have a place to turn when you want the truth on bodybuilding, diet, and exercise. Up-to-the-minute news and more. Visit the RxMuscle.com forums featuring celebrity Q&As with IFBB professional athletes, top amateurs, and the brightest minds in the industry. Listen to our weekly radio shows, including Heavy Muscle Radio, Muscle Girls Inc., After Hours, and more. Contest coverage, videos, even our own social networking site, RX Muscle Place. Visit RxMuscle.com.
All right, here on the phone I have Larry Pepe, the host of Pro MMA Radio, also the resident expert on Pro Bodybuilding Weekly. Larry, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me here.
I told you earlier, but I just want to reiterate, I've been a fan of yours and your work, your shows, for many, many years now.
I appreciate that. That's very flattering, and I'm glad that people like what I do and that they respond well, and I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you.
Absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to start, since Christina's not here this week, I wanted to start with a bit of news. And not only does it, it kind of pertains to you, since you are the resident expert on Pro Bodybuilding Weekly, since this topic was brought up on Pro Bodybuilding Weekly. This week, Dan and Lee and Chad, it was really just Lee had already left, so it was really just Chad and Dan talked a little bit about Tukai Green and a little bit about the Kai Green guru drama. That's what I called it in the gossip column, where Oscar Arden came on and I spoke to Oscar about their relationship kind of dissolving and the fact that Oscar felt like he kind of lost a friend when he lost Kai. And so Dan had Kai on and he asked him about the switching to George Farah and basically leaving Oscar, and Kai really was he almost seemed like he didn't really want to talk about it. You think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I did hear that interview and it seemed like Kai wanted to keep it between him and Oscar. He seemed reluctant to really get into any specifics, but he did keep saying things like, you know, people only know what they hear and things like that. So it seems like there's something beneath the surface for him in that relationship that didn't work out, but not something he wanted to really go terribly public with.
You know, the funny thing is when I talked to Oscar, one of Oscar's main points of contention with this whole thing was that since he considered Kai a friend and really a family member, he felt like the fact that he had been calling him and texting him and not receiving any response since the Olympia, you know, it seems like, you know, obviously that if you heard the interview with Oscar, he felt very hurt by the whole thing. And it seems like Oscar, from what I understand, speaking to Oscar, that Oscar doesn't even know the reasons that these reasons that Kai was alluding to.
Right. And that's the tough part to kind of get your head around, because, you know, I did have the opportunity to talk to both Oscar and Kai at the past Olympia. And, you know, Oscar was devastated that Kai did not do better. And I think, in all fairness, he would say that he felt like some of that burden was on him. He talked about them trying new things, which is never a great idea before a contest to really start experimenting a lot. I always felt that Kai had developed a formula with Oscar that brought him that crazy, grainy detail and muscularity that you just don't see on too many athletes. And I think when you do something like that, when you figure that formula out, making a lot of deviations from that, coming into a show with the magnitude of the Olympia, is a huge mistake. But I felt that Oscar, because of the personal nature of their relationship, felt terrible. So I think, given how much they've grown together and how much they've had to do with one another, it would be surprising that there'd be no communication if that relationship were going to end. But I think it also suggests that there's something real deep in this for Kai, for him not to talk to a guy that he described as his mentor and his friend and his brother. And I think at the end of the day, there's only two people that are going to know the real depth of that story, and that's the two of them, you know? And it's hard for us from the outside to really know what the dynamics were that led to the split and what the dynamics are, especially in Kai's mind, because he hasn't really spoken too openly about it now, you know? But I think it brings up another issue, Aaron, because the whole issue of gurus and athletes, a lot of people have said, you know, Kai didn't do well. So that's why he must have left Oscar, because we see it often enough where in these guru/athlete relationships, sometimes athletes feel when they do well that gurus take too much credit, and sometimes they do. Other times we see when they don't do well, it's like a revolving merry-go-round. You hear of an athlete going from one guru to another, trying to unlock this formula, if you will.
Right.
And it's ironic because a lot of these same guys got into fantastic shape as amateurs before they ever had gurus, but then somehow completely lose the ability to get themselves in shape once they turn pro. And I think it's been interesting watching guys like Centopani and Dennis Wolf say, I'm doing it on my own, and they right now look the best they've ever looked.
Do you think that that's a result of them just knowing their body better than other people? Or where do you attribute this?
I think that's a big part of it. And listen, for every guy who does better by himself, there's going to be another guy who does better with a particular guru, and that's fine. But I think, you know, sometimes we get lazy. And sometimes, you know, like I when I did the pre-contest Bible, not as a cheap plug since we sold out, but when I did the book, it amazed me. One of the questions I asked every guy in the book was, what was the best condition you ever got in? And it was amazing how many of them chose to show that they turned pro at, right, as an amateur, like the Nationals or the USA, and not a show they did as a pro. And I think that sometimes guys don't, they get to that next level, and we see it with guys who like feel like, oh, I got to be 20 pounds bigger, and they throw their physiques off or they don't come in shape. Well, sometimes that, I think that fear of going into the pros and competing against guys at the next level sometimes makes athletes feel, because this is a, it's an insecure business, you know, bodybuilding's tough mentally and emotionally. And I think they feel like, hey, you know what, now that I'm at this level, I need somebody to take me to that level. And sometimes that's absolutely true, but I think what we're also seeing is that there's other times where sometimes you do know your body best, and you can feel your way through it just like you did before, and maybe get in even better shape. And I think that we're seeing some athletes go that way, and it's interesting that they're being very verbal that they're going that way.
Well, you bring up a good example with Dennis Wolf. I think his best conditioning, if you look back, was when he was still an amateur, when he did the World Championships. He was in amazing condition. I don't even know if he's replicated that kind of condition at this new size.
Yeah, and I think the closest he's come to that condition was just these past couple of shows. Not the California show. He looked terrible there, and I was at that event and stunned. When I saw him there, and I thought, there's just, I can't imagine how he can make up any significant distance between where he's at today and the Arnold in 2 weeks. And I've got to give him props, man. Like, if you were to put me in a time capsule and took me out and said, how long do you think it's been since you saw him in California and this condition, I would have thought it was like the Olympia. Like, I would have never thought that he could have brought his physique back together in those 2 weeks. And I give him props for that. But I think that's the closest that he's been.
You know, some people might say, Larry, that he wasn't ever planning on doing that Flex Pro show. I don't know if you might have heard that.
I have heard that. And the way he showed up at the show, if he was planning on doing it, he certainly wasn't planning on peaking for it.
Right.
And that's just, honestly, Aaron, that's just never a strategy I agree with. Like, I've heard athletes say, you know, I'm just doing this show as a tune-up. I'm not really peaking for this show. Then don't do the show, because you're representing your physique out there, and putting a physique on stage that you're planning on not being in great shape, I don't think is ever a good idea.
No.
I really don't.
I don't think so either. I want to bring it back to Kai Greene for one more second, about one more thing he said on the interview. I thought it was surprising that Kai seemed so surprised and mystified that people would be interested in the fact of what happened with Oscar and him, considering that he had been talking, he called him his mentor, you know, a brother, a father figure. You know, I felt like that was very surprising. Didn't you think that was kind of weird that he feels like almost like he shocked that people are interested?
Yeah, you know, I think that Kai's just an interesting character, an interesting personality all around. And I think he's the word I'm looking for. And I say this in a flattering way. There's an innocence to Kai in certain ways. And I'm sure Oscar probably wouldn't agree at the moment because of the way things ended. But there is like an innocence to him, like, wow, I can't believe people would care about that. And that's why it doesn't totally surprise me that he is surprised, but if I were in his shoes, I wouldn't be surprised, because the reality is that off stage, not a hell of a lot happens around the bodybuilding community.
Right.
You know, I mean, so when there are these divisions or splits or things that seem out of the ordinary to take us by surprise, I think it's natural for people to question it and be interested in it. And I think Kai underestimates where he is on the bodybuilding ladder in terms of prominence. I mean, he's a two-time Arnold Classic winner. He's probably the guy most likely to be in a position to upset the apple cart at the Olympia for the, you know, higher-ranked athletes right now. I remember seeing pictures of Kai, a video of Kai guest posing a couple of weeks out, maybe it was like 5 weeks out from the Olympia.
Right.
And he was with Branch Warren and Johnny Jackson, and he didn't look human. I mean, he was just enormous. He was rock hard. He was like in the 280s, and I thought, good God, like, I don't know how anybody's going to beat that guy. And then they just didn't bring it in right, and it didn't work out for him. But I think Kai underestimates that at his best, he is a perennial challenger for the Mr. Olympia. That makes him, you know, one of the best handful of bodybuilders in the world. And people are going to be interested in what goes on with you, especially when it looks like there might be some controversy around it.
Of course. Larry, let me ask you about something else that happened this week in bodybuilding. Dexter Jackson was let go from Six Star, which is obviously a branch of Iovate Muscle Tech. This is a big contract for them to let go. You have any thoughts on what happened, or the new, if they're having a new strategy over there, or anything like that?
Well, I didn't know that Dexter had been let go. It surprised me a little bit, only because I think the world of Dexter is an athlete, and I think, you know, people are kind of writing Dexter off. And while I don't think he's going to challenge for an Olympia title anymore, I think he made some mistakes in terms of his preparation coming into the early season this year. I still think he's a very, very dangerous guy. And for people that say, you know what, this is proof that Dexter's done, he's finished, I don't believe that. I think he's done challenging to win the Mr. Olympia. But I think on any given day, he's a very dangerous guy for anybody outside of the top two or three guys right now. I have heard that Six Star and Muscle Tech had cut quite a few athletes recently.
Right.
So I can only assume, not having any personal knowledge of any of it, that they're just being very, very particular as to who they're keeping on their roster. And I guess a couple of bad showings with Dexter was enough for them to feel like they should maybe spend that money elsewhere, or maybe not spend that money at all.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I was discussing this with Dave Palumbo off the air, we were thinking that you know, a lot of this actually pertains to you a little bit with Pro MMA Radio. It seems like a lot of companies are sponsoring MMA athletes, and I know Muscle Tech has one under contract now. You think maybe they're trying to expand their potential customer base by, you know, is that something you could see happening?
Listen, we're seeing lots of advertising dollars move into the mixed martial arts market. How much companies remove it from the bodybuilding market and into the MMA market is going to be dependent on how much they see that market from a supplement standpoint. I think the smarter companies are seeing, like Ultimate Nutrition sponsors my show, and they have a line called Full Combat that's designed more specifically for the MMA people. And, of course, the Ultimate line's been around for like 30 years. And they see the reason that they spend those dollars with me is because they see that the size of the mixed martial arts market and the demographic. I think what a lot of companies miss is that the demographic of people who follow MMA is very, very to the demographic of people who follow bodybuilding.
Yeah.
They're in that, you know, 18 to, you know, 40s. They're people who, you know, like aggressive sports. They're people who definitely train, definitely take care of themselves. If you look at a lot of the styles in mixed martial arts, they're not geared for someone who's, you know, out of shape. They're very clingy. They're geared for people to show off their taper and their physique. So I think some of these companies are becoming smart, and they're saying, hey, you know what? We're going to spend some dollars in that MMA market because it's a very similar demographic to who we're trying to get in the bodybuilding market, but there's so many more of them because the sport is so much larger. So would it surprise me that a company says, hey, we're going to budget, maybe we're going to take a little out of this budget and put it into this budget and see how it translates for us? No, that wouldn't surprise me at all. But I don't know that that has anything to do with why they made the move they did with Dexter or with the, a lot of other athletes that they let go that you were just referring to.
Now, just one more question about this. You mentioned about the demographics of the MMA crowd. The one thing that I noticed the difference in between the MMA and bodybuilding crowd is a lot of the people who follow bodybuilding that are fans, almost all of them are in the gym training. When I go to UFC, I went to one recently. I noticed a lot of the fans, obviously don't train. You know what I mean? They're there to watch the fights. They're drinking beer. They're not they're not necessarily in shape. Do you think that the percentages still favor that? You know what I mean?
Well, I think you have to look at it this way. Let's say that if you go to the Olympia, 90% of the people there train.
Right. And numbers. So you're saying the numbers make up that.
And that's fine. So let's say you have, 6,000-7,000 people. Well, UFC's running an event on April 30th in Toronto with 55,000 people. So if half of those people train, now you have 27,000 people who train sitting in the audience. So I think, I think the percentage of people who train is always going to be higher in bodybuilding than any other sport in the world. But then you also have to factor in the density of the fan base.
Right.
And I think that's where MMA has a big advantage. And I think it's wise for companies to look at both, because you do have a different type of personality in the two. You do have a different type of client, but demographically they're very similar. And I think on the MMA side, we have to educate the fans and the fighters, to be honest, more about the use of supplements and things like that, because if they understand more about how those supplements can benefit them and their particular goals, then you have the best of both worlds. I think in bodybuilding, everyone understands it because that's part of what you do and what you follow. It's ingrained in you, whether you're a competitor or just somebody who trains a lot and follows the sport. So you don't have to get over that hurdle. In MMA, I think you have to do a little more education.
Right. That makes sense. Larry, the main reason, the original reason I wanted to have you on the show was because I wrote an article a few weeks ago about the future of the 202 division, because of the prize money hasn't went up a whole lot. The sponsorship contracts really haven't been there that much. And some of these guys like Flex Lewis recently are doing the open shows. I know a whole list of them. Jason Arndt's, Jose Raymond, Eduardo Correa has moved up, Seth Ferosi has moved up. It's a long list of guys that are either moving up or trying their hand in the open this year. And there's only one guy in the top 10, or one guy 202 that has a magazine contract, being Kevin English. Seth Ferosi does, I know, but he's gone now, or he's in the open as of this year. And then only three out of the top 10 guys have sponsorship contracts. That was what the article was based on. But in response to that article, I got lots and lots of email questions about what is 202? What's the significance of this number? Is it arbitrary? Why not a higher number? Why not a lower number? Should there be other weight divisions? So I thought, who best to call but you, since how I first heard about the whole 202 division was an article you wrote, and then the radio shows you did talking about it and debating Larry. Who did you debate? You debated Lonnie Tieper.
Lonnie Tieper. Yeah.
Right. So give us some background on the 202 division and kind of sum this up, answer some of these questions for my listeners here.
Sure. Well, for me, where it started for me was, when I went to the Olympia a couple of years ago, I think it was 06. It was 05, I'm sorry. And I remember sitting there and seeing Ronnie Coleman look, unbelievable and monstrous and 280 something, and then remember Johnny Jackson having to come out and stand there at probably about 215, 210, and I just remember looking up there and thinking, man, haven't we gotten to a point in the sport where we have to create some competitive balance for the smaller athletes? And of course, smaller is relative, but when you're standing next to Ronnie and Jay and Tony Freeman at 280 or 290 and guys like that, I think it just struck me that we're kind of missing the boat a little bit if we don't do something to bring the smaller athletes into a more competitive situation. Because what we would always say is, a guy who's a middleweight, even a light heavyweight, turns pro, it's like, that's it, it's over. And we saw guys like Jose Raymond, who qualified to turn pro like, I think, 5, 6, 7 times, and he turned the card down every time until recently, because his career basically would be over.
Right.
So would you rather be a top amateur who's going to the USA and going to nationals and winning or being competitive first, second, third in your division and have that goal and knowing that it's a reasonable goal. But you want to take the pro card, frame it, and basically sign the death warrant to your career. So we had nowhere for these guys to go. And the ironic thing is that when you look at guys who are smaller in stature by our standards, they're usually guys that in a lot of respects are more marketable. You look at a Mark Dugdale, for example, who was like a prime buck in my mind when I wrote the article because he had just turned pro like a year before. He had a certain look, very marketable look. And I always said, and this is no disrespect to Ronnie, Jay, or anybody else, but if you take Dugdale and you walk him down a beach in between Ronnie and Jay, who he'll never beat in competition, my guess is 80-90% of the men and women on that beach are going to favor Mark's physique because it looks more attainable. It looks more streamlined. And we as like hardcore bodybuilding fans might prefer the Ronnie physique, but I'm talking about the average person. And we've always talked about how do we expand the sport beyond the hardcore audience? How do we make it more mainstream? How do we get it out there more to the masses? And it was ironic to me that the smaller guys who are probably more attainable looking to the masses might get them more motivated, get them more interested. Once they turn pro, you couldn't find them because they weren't going to be competitive. So that's where the idea for the weight classes came from for me. And I wrote a very extensive article proposing three-way classes, proposing, you know, a smaller class that I think I had around 215 or 220 because when I did the weight of the athletes at the Olympia, the breaking point was around 210, 215, I believe, for the smaller class. And then the over 250, I think, was the number for the higher and then everyone else in the middle. And the idea marketability-wise was, I remember using Johnny Jackson as an example that year. Like, Johnny was 11th at that Olympia. He would have been first in this lighter division, if you will. So from a marketability standpoint for Johnny, is Johnny better as the lightweight Mr. Olympia or a guy who took 11th at the Olympia? Pretty obvious, right?
Of course.
So from a standpoint of endorsement, to the standpoint of his competitive drive and encouraging more athletes who were the lighter guys to continue pro careers, it just made sense to me to do something with the weight classes. And that was before we got to this 202. Initially, it was 210. That's when Silvio Samuel won the Europa. And then it got dropped to 202. I don't know why. I don't particularly like the drop. I like 205 or 210, something that's round. I don't know where the 202 exactly came from. But that's the number they settled on. Theoretically, I love that these guys have a place to compete. And listen, Kevin English was retired. Kevin English was not breaking the top 12 or 13 at the New York Pro before the 202 came along. Guys like Mike Valentino were long gone from the sport. Mark Dugdale was, you know, fighting to make the top five, except for the Ironman. You know, guy with a great physique, very marketable physique, but at 202, he became an immediate monster. You know, so you look at these guys. Jose Raymond took his pro card. He never took his pro card before the 202 came around. And now you had guys who were winning the light heavyweight division competing a week or two later in a 202 event, whereas before they would be thinking, how can I gain 15 or 20 pounds of muscle and blow my physique out when maybe it's not going to look right with those extra 15 pounds of muscle just to be able to compete with bigger guys. So I think it's a great thing for bodybuilding. I think it's a great thing for the marketing. As far as the sponsorship and advertising dollars, the fact that any of these guys have contracts with supplement companies that didn't have contracts before says something, you know? Because guys like Jose Raymond didn't have a supplement deal before the 202. Kevin English didn't have a supplement deal or a magazine deal. Mark Dugdale was with Muscle Mag and has a supplement deal as a 202. Flex Lewis has a publication deal and a supplement deal as a 202 guy. David Henry, same thing. I know he doesn't have a publication deal now, but he had them. And you have to wonder, without the 202, would they have had any of those deals or would they have been able to maintain them for any period of time? And I think the answer in large part is probably no.
Right. It's true. It's true. So something is better than nothing is what you're saying.
Listen, if you have no place to compete and be competitive and you're not making any money, and now you have some place to compete where you know you don't have to stand next to guys who are 220 and 230 and 270, and you have the potential to make some money, it's got to be better than having nowhere to go, you know?
It's true. Do you think that the 202 division will continue to pick up steam? I mean, do you think that the prize money will eventually raise? I know one good thing. The Olympia is now paying for the I don't know if everybody knew that, but the Olympia did not pay for the 202 guys to go or their hotel rooms until this current year. So now at least there's that.
Yeah, listen, I think we're seeing some moves forward, and listen, here's the other thing. We can't really expect leaps and bounds in the 202 if there's not leaps and bounds in the open. Like, if we agree that the open is the more, you know, appealing to the hardcore fan, it's what the sport's been built around, and it will always be. If the prize money's not going up exponentially at all the smaller shows in the open, then we have to give the 202 time to pick up some steam. But I don't know how much it's, I don't know how reasonable it is to look at it and say, well, listen, the 202, the prize money is not going up. Well, is the prize money going up in the open shows very much? Not really.
No.
And we're also dealing in a bad economy. So I just think, you know, from a competitor standpoint, at the end of the day, giving guys a place to compete. Look, Aaron, the reality is very few people get into bodybuilding for money. And if they do, they're not that smart. They're either incredibly genetically gifted or not that smart. If bodybuilding is the way that they're going to think that they're going to earn $1 million, there's not a lot of Jay Cutlers and Phil Heaths and Ronnie Coleman's out there. There just isn't. So most people, the overwhelming majority, 99% of the people who get into bodybuilding get into it because they love it. They get into it because they love to train and they love to challenge themselves and set a goal and diet and compete and get themselves in great shape and then assess themselves and say, okay, I'm going to do another show in 6 months and I'm going to improve my biceps or I'm going to improve my chest. They don't get into it for money. So when you have all these tremendous competitors in their weight classes as amateurs who have a place to compete and a drive to compete, and now they turn pro and literally they're done. That sucks.
Yeah.
So if we can provide a place for them to continue to compete and follow their passion, then they have to make a decision. Is it worth it? You know, when the prize money is X or when I'm probably not going to get a supplement sponsorship, or do I just love to do this? And I think a lot of guys answer it the second way.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. That's definitely true, Larry. Let's segue a little bit to Pro MMA Radio. And, you know, I know your background with radio, but kind of give us a quick rundown of how you got started doing radio and how you ended up doing Pro MMA Radio.
Sure. I started out with Muscle Radio and Hard Body Radio. Those were two shows I did on my own, probably about 4 years ago now. And I did about 50, 60 episodes of both, enjoyed it. At that point, you know, I wasn't affiliated with any particular magazine or anything like that. And I'm sure you know that given the landscape in bodybuilding with the different contracts and publication deals that different magazines have with different athletes, if you're not affiliated with any of those entities, putting together a guest list after a while can be a little difficult. And this was before Muscular Development had a radio show. And Steve Bleckman and I met and talked. And he asked me to, in essence, bring Muscle Radio to MD and co-host with Dave Palumbo and John Romano. And we did that for a couple of months. Had some different ideas, ultimately, as to kind of the direction that the show was going to take. And I decided that it was good for me to move on.
Can you be more specific? Tell me what didn't you agree with? What broke it up?
You know, here's my thing. If you're going to do a mixed martial arts show, then it should be 99% mixed martial arts. If you're going to do a bodybuilding show, it should be incredibly focused on bodybuilding, because I think the difference between mainstream, you know, terrestrial radio when you're driving around in your car and you're pushing buttons and you're listening to two guys, you know, go shoot the stuff about, you know, what they did today or stuff like that. It can be interesting for that short period of time, but you don't have an expectation when you tune into a particular station that it's going to be about a specific topic. When you tune in online or through iTunes, and when a listener is gracious enough to say, I'm going to take an hour, hour and a half of my time, and I'm going to sit at this computer and listen to what you do, or I'm going to, you know, listen on my iTunes, and I'm going to focus on that. I think you have to deliver to them what you are. So if you're a bodybuilding show, I think a bodybuilding fan, when they tune into PBW, when they tune into your show, Access Bodybuilding, they want bodybuilding. That's what they want, right. You know, and I think that Dave and John just had a little different vision, and so did Steve at the time, of making it more variety type based, you know, not focused completely on bodybuilding. And my vision was a bit different, and I just realized that we were kind of like pushing and pulling with each other, and it wasn't worth doing that. If they had a certain vision, I'm not going to step in anybody else's way. That's why I do my own thing a lot of times. And I felt for them, they wanted to go in that direction. Ultimately, after I left, I think they experimented with it for a while, and maybe 4 to 6 weeks later, they started doing exactly what I would have done. And I think they realized that maybe that format wasn't what the MD visitors wanted. And if you look at the show now and what it became after I left, it became a more conventional talk radio bodybuilding show, which was kind of where I was coming from and what I'd done with Muscle Radio. So I got out of radio for a while, had a blast, enjoyed doing it, left no bad feelings with anybody along the way. Dan Solomon, about a year later, contacted me and said that he wanted to expand Pro Bodybuilding Weekly and make it longer. And he asked me if I would, in essence, host the last half hour of the show. And I told him that I would be open to doing it as long as I wasn't restricted to only interview bodybuilders, because I felt that with all the shows that had popped up, and Dan and Bob were doing a fantastic job with what they do, they were already interviewing a lot of top guys. I felt like, let me branch out. Let me do some other things besides pure bodybuilding, but bring it back to training and nutrition and stuff like that. So long story shorter, I interviewed James Irvin and Uriah Faber, both to Irvin at the time was a rising star in the UFC. Faber was an established star in the WBC and 145-pound world champion. Interviewed the two of them. Their manager, they're both managed by a gentleman named Jeff Meyer, MMA Incorporated, great manager, one of the elite managers in MMA. And he called me, and he said, I have to be honest with you, like, I've heard these guys interviewed hundreds of times, and I've never really heard them interviewed quite the way you interviewed them. And I thought he was, like, bullshitting me, because I was like, okay, so what's the big deal? Like, I did the same type of interview I did 100 times with bodybuilders. I didn't think it was anything that out of the ordinary. And he persuaded me. He said, no, I'm telling you, you know, like, the radio shows in MMA are not as focused, not as professional, don't ask the types of questions you were asking these guys, and they both enjoyed it. I think you should think about doing something on a regular basis. And that's really what got me started doing Pro MMA Radio. I was very fortunate to pick up sponsors very early on because they were familiar with what I did on the bodybuilding side. And now the show's been around for coming up on 3 years in June. We've been featured on Spike TV. We've been featured on Jim Rome. I got to do an interview with him. We've been interviewed on, featured on about 70 different websites, including every major sports website you can think of. So it's been a fantastic ride, and I've been very grateful to Form Athletics and Ultimate Nutrition, because they're the two sponsors that support the show and have just allowed me to do what I do. So that's how it all kind of came about.
Well, let me ask you, you know, I'm a fan of UFC and MMA in general. So I'm familiar. I'm not as familiar with the whole sport as you are, the personalities involved, but I do follow the sport and the fighters. And I know you've interviewed just about everybody. So tell me, who is the biggest assholes you've interviewed, and who's the nicest guys?
Oh, boy. Well, here's the thing. The biggest asshole question is difficult, because every guy I've interviewed is capable of whipping my ass. So that's what you have to keep in mind. You know, it's a little different than other sports. I will tell you this, and I'm not being insincere. I'm not anymore because I'm used to it, but I was consistently impressed by just how nice everybody was, the fighters that I interviewed, respectful. There was, like, in 2.5 years, I've only had a handful of times that guys have no-showed and generally been very apologetic afterwards. So I can't really say, like, anyone's been, like, a dick to me.
You've never asked any questions where they were like you had to ask a pointed question and they're like, you know, got pissed off?
I haven't had anyone get pissed. And I think because at the end of the day, so if I do have, and I ask pointed questions all the time, but I think if you do it respectfully, you don't get the negative reaction. And I think another thing is that these guys are so used to being in the media because of the popularity of the sport, and they get interviewed all the time, radio, sometimes television, a lot of print, a lot of web stuff, that I don't think they get as emotional in reactions as, say, if you have a bodybuilder who, you know, doesn't get interviewed much, and then they get really offended because, you know, you ask them something. Most of the time with the MMA guys, there's probably not too much I'm going to throw at them that they haven't had to respond to in some way, shape, or form before, you know? So I can't really say anybody's been, like, really hard to deal with or terrible to deal with. On the positive side, Rashad Evans is actually a regular on my show. He comes on every month for a segment called Sugar and Pep, and I find him to be very articulate. We've become friends off-air, so it's very friendly, you know, so I would say he's a very misunderstood guy. He's not liked by the fans because he's beat a lot of fan favorites, and he can be a little cocky sometimes, but that's part of his personality in the cage, and sometimes hardcore fans get pissed off at that. But I'd say Rashad, Uriah Faber, not too many people nicer than that guy, you know, and he was my very first guest, and it's come full circle in that Form Athletics is a company that he actually started with a gentleman named Mark Miller, and they became my apparel sponsor a couple of months ago. So that's been an interesting relationship, and I always had a soft spot for Uriah because he was the very first guy I had on the show, and had I not had him on early and been contacted by his manager, I don't know that I would have done the show. So I would say those guys stand out to me right away, but honest to God, like with hundreds of guests, everybody's been really cool. Some a little more than others, but everybody's been really cool.
Do you find that these guys have some kind of a camaraderie with each other? I mean, in bodybuilding, there's certainly a degree. Everybody knows everybody. You know, is it similar in the UFC and MMA?
Yeah, there's a lot of camaraderie. I think, you hear about that 6 degrees of separation, and I think, you know, what people don't realize in mixed martial arts is that as big as the sport is, there are a handful of top camps. And while the sport has grown, and I had Greg Jackson on 2 weeks ago, and Greg has perhaps the most loaded camp in MMA, with Jackson's MMA in Albuquerque. And, you know, I talked to him about this, and he agreed that as the sport has grown, the number of camps that are considered elite camps, you know, like Jackson's, like Extreme Couture, a.k.a. up in Northern California, the Gracie camp in Northern California as well, ATT in Florida, you know, and then there's a couple more, I'm sure I'm not remembering everybody, but what's happened is that instead of like going from 6 or 7 camps to, you know, 25 camps, it's basically that those camps become more loaded with top talent. So when you have a finite number of camps that the top guys go to, you'd be amazed at who crosses whose paths along the way. And I think there is a huge degree of camaraderie. Obviously, there's guys that can't stand each other, and those make for those feuds that, you know, make for fantastic marketing for the fights and promoting the fight. And a lot of times those fights live up to the billing. But overall, I think there's a tremendous camaraderie level in MMA. And I think a lot of it is because there's so much cross-section between these top camps where top athletes really get a chance to train with one another, know one another, even if they're just at that camp for a week or two, and then they go back to their home camp.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool. It's nice to, you know, obviously with bodybuilding, there's some degree of that, but it's maybe a little bit more competitive, you know, more of a rivalry slash camaraderie, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think the difference is that as a bodybuilder, you know, you could go your whole life and never have a training partner.
Right,
you know?
That's true.
You go your whole life, go in the gym, do your thing, get in shape, compete, and you could never have a training partner your whole life. In MMA, in any combat sport, you know, there's a saying, iron sharpens iron. Like, you need other athletes to train with and challenge you and push and spar with and grapple with and all this other stuff. Otherwise, you can't become any good. So there's a greater degree of reliance on your fellow athlete in MMA than there is in a more individual sport like bodybuilding.
Larry, on a totally off-topic subject, a few weeks ago, maybe it was about a month ago or a little more, I had a Big Will World Harris on the radio show, and
Will's awesome.
Yeah, he mentioned you were one of his very best friends on in the universe, I believe he said. So, tell me a little bit about Will Harris. I mean, how did you guys get to be friends? And are you also a vampire?
No, I gave up my fangs a couple of years ago. I thought it was time to move on, you know. But Will is, although I'll tell you what, man, one of the reasons that's a joke between us is because we're both late night people. So I've probably spoken to Will more after 1 a.m. than before 1 a.m. when it comes to phone calls, you know.
Right.
But Will and I met back in Gold's. I had moved out to California. I was training on my own. I was getting ready for some natural shows and stuff. Will was in the gym. We started training a bit together, became friends, and we've just been friends ever since. You know, he's one of those guys that I consider a true friend. Like, you know, we don't live near each other anymore. Whenever I'm in Los Angeles, I take the time and we grab a bite or hang out a bit. But we just have that relationship over years that even if I don't speak to him for a month, we could get on the phone tomorrow, and it's just one of those deals like, you know, we just spoke an hour ago. And he's definitely a very loyal friend. Like, he'll do anything for you, and I'm the same with him. And I've watched him progress, and I was his worst enemy for a while, because when he insisted on competing in the 250s and 260s, you know, I was always hitting him in the head and saying, dude, you need to be a heavyweight. You need to go down to 225, you'll get your pro card. You need to go down to 225, you'll get your pro card. You're wasting your potential. He went down to 225, won the LA, dominated the USA, got his pro card along with Mark Dugdale that year.
Right.
And now he's a full-blown, you know, whatever he competes at now in the 260s or whatever. But he had so much potential, Aaron, like structurally, but he would always come in heavy because he'd let himself get too heavy in the off season. And I think what happens sometimes is that, you know, he's walking around at 300. When he gets to 250, he looks really lean in comparison to what he's used to seeing. And when he really took it upon himself to get down that extra weight, people were stunned at what was under there, because structurally the guy's a freak. And he's got some crazy body parts. So I'm happy for him, man. I was thrilled when he got his pro card, and really happy for him. And he's going to get back on stage this year.
Yeah,
and I saw him about a month ago. And he was gigantic and not fat. And I think that when you see him on stage this year, it should be the best version we've seen of him. And if you looked at him at that Europa when he took fourth, where I thought he got completely screwed. I mean, I thought he should have been challenging for the title at that event. I think he's going to look better than that. And that's a freaky physique. I hope he does well in Connecticut, of course, because he's a friend of mine. But I think he's going to. I really do.
One last question about Will, and we'll actually conclude the interview. How much of the stuff Will told me is shtick, and how much is reality?
What did he tell you?
Oh, he's a vampire. He's 600 years old. You know, all the kind of the shtick or the stuff you usually hear him say.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know how much of that can be reality.
No, you know what I mean. Obviously, you know Larry.
But if you're asking me if he's crazy enough to think he's 600, I think the answer is no. Okay. Although at times I'm not 100% sure. But now Will's a unique cat, and he has a great sense of humor. And one thing that's cool about him is you almost never catch him in a bad mood. You know, whether he's dieting, whether he's off season and eating whatever he wants and happy, he's always in a good spirit. And I admire that in him, and I envy that in him, because, you know, I don't see that guy have too many bad days, and I know I have them. Everyone else I know has them, and sometimes I'm like, damn, I'd like to figure out how to do that, because he seems to have that part figured out for himself.
Maybe you just need a regular supply of virgin blood.
Either that, or I think I need to get the fangs. I have a feeling if you get the fangs, maybe you laugh every time you look at them in the mirror, and it just puts you in a good mood. You know,
maybe that's it.
That could be it.
Well, Larry, let everybody know how to get in touch with you and how to hear your radio show.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Simplest thing is just go to prommaradio.com, and the show airs every Monday night at 6 p.m. Pacific live, and then our replays are available right after that. And we also developed a player for the show. If you go to ProMMARadioNetwork.com, any website that wants to air our show, air the replays of our show, we designed this player so they can do that. And that's helped us a lot in terms of expanding our audience. So now we have 21 websites that air the show and air the replays, and that's been fantastic. So, and I appreciate you having me on, Aaron. It's been great talking to you and kind of talking shop. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak to your listeners and tell us some stories and let them know about the radio show as well.
Absolutely, Larry. I hope to have you on again in the future. I know you've got a lot of stories and a lot of insight you could share.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, that was Larry Pepe, and I was glad to have him on the show. Thank you all for listening to Access Bodybuilding again this week. Next week, hopefully, we'll have Christina Voynich back, and we'll have a full show, and it'll be our normal presentation. But I hope you enjoyed this one, and please email me if you have anything you'd like to say, feedback, suggestions, survey questions, etc. Of course, you can email me, as usual, at Jubacca, Jubacca, at rxmuscle.com. Thank you all for listening to Access Bodybuilding. Until next week, this is Aaron Singerman signing off.